Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, more than 4,000 solar panels are installed in the Amherst community, citizens taking charge of their free energy needs.
That solar garden is going to produce enough power to power roughly 240 homes.
In Mansonville, Quebec, a local history buff revives what was once an international destination, the Pas de Natural Springs.
I just want to share it with people. It's such an amazing place. And like I said, you can't really put into words the feelings that you get when you're standing in some of these places. It bothers me beyond words that history dies out so easily.
Roller derby is making a comeback in British Columbia. The Bulkley Valley Bruisers are looking for new teammates.
There is an art and a skill to learning how to fall safely and how to use your pads and use your gear to your advantage. And I've never played a team sport before. I've never played a contact sport before. I'm the oldest person on the team with the least experience. You know, at some point you have to let passion overrule your fear.
And a 70-year-old tractor from the 1950s is being proudly displayed on Cortis Island, a legacy of the island's past.
She runs just fine. She's a little rickety on the roads or on uneven ground, but we've used her in Cortis Island parades. And yeah, we just love vintage tractors and we wanted to keep her here on the island.
Welcome to Viewpoints. The city of Amherst in Nova Scotia is home to the first community solar garden of the province. The new installation is located some 200 kilometers from Halifax and a stone's throw away from New Brunswick's 15 wind turbines operated by the Capstone Infrastructure Company. The Amherst Industrial Park installed close to 4,500 solar panels. They collect energy on behalf of about 200 Nova Scotia Power customers, all who are paying a monthly fee to help run the community solar program. To find out more about how the community solar garden works, our journalist in Sackville, Erica Butler, spoke with Sean Connell, the Director of Customer Solutions at Nova Scotia Power.
Community solar is a way for us to offer solar energy to all Nova Scotians. So it doesn't matter if you live in an apartment building, if you live in a condo, if your house can't support solar panels, or you may have a roof that's not quite situated in the right way to optimize, the sun. This allows you to get access to solar in increments that you're able to manage, and you don't have to have that kind of upfront cost of installing solar on your roof. So it's an alternative. And it's an easy way for customers to get access to renewable energy.
The Amherst Solar Garden represents just a small percentage of the generating power size of its wind turbine neighbors, but the 10-acre lot will still make a dent in the power needs of the region.
We've installed almost 4,500 solar panels on a large piece of land in the Amherst Industrial Park, and that solar garden is going to produce enough power to power roughly 240 homes, or if you look at it from an electric vehicle perspective, 700 electric vehicles. And it's going to allow us to offer solar energy from anywhere to 200 to 400 customers.
Those customers will in turn pay a premium to cover the operating cost of the solar garden. And just as if they had installed the panels on their own home, over time, they will recoup the costs as their investment generates solar energy.
How it works is a customer can subscribe to a certain amount of energy production from the solar garden. There's a monthly subscription fee, and then for the amount of energy that the customer signs up for. And so we're signing customers up for kilowatt blocks, and so $6.86 a month per kilowatt, up to a maximum of 100 kilowatts. And then the customer, in turn, gets all of the energy produced from that subscription that they have. And so they in turn get a credit every month for the energy that's produced, the solar energy that's produced on their bill.
Connell says the project is fully covered by participating customers.
Anybody that is not participating is not responsible for paying for the cost. And so if we're fully subscribed, those customers pay for the operation of the solar garden, and they get the benefit of the energy that's produced. On average, I think if you looked at the subscription fee that you pay per month and the credit that you would get back, I think in the first number of years it would equate to about $3 a month of a premium you'd pay to be a member of the solar farm. But if you were to subscribe, let's say over the life of the asset, which would be 25 years, which would be similar to a customer doing it at their home, there would be savings. Depending on the amount of energy that you're producing. So if I was just looking at the average installation, you're probably looking at approximately $1,500 over a 25-year life that you would save.
Nova Scotia Power also received contributions from the federal government to make the project happen. They put out 3.5 of the $5 million cost to build the solar garden, and the provincial government and the town of Amherst are also listed as partners on the project. The project is not just piloting a community-funded subscription system, but also testing out new technologies that could help maximize the energy potential of solar production.
The panels that we're using are called bifacial panels, so it allows us to, when the sun is shining directly on them, energy is being produced, and when the sun is reflecting off the ground, we're getting energy produced from that reflection on the backside of the panel as well. So this is part of the learnings that we're getting.
Connell says the company is also experimenting with ground covers in an attempt to find one most suitable for reflecting energy up to the panels. The whole project is part of Nova Scotia Power's Smart Grid Initiative, which aims to find the next great technologies that will help the company increase its production of renewables.
It's allowing us to understand a variety of different technologies that will help us transition to the state that we're working towards in the province, which is net zero, and the targets that we're working towards right now are 80% renewable by 2030, and the elimination of coal generation. So all of these technologies that we're piloting at the moment will be part and help us transition.
About 60% of the power Nova Scotia Power distributes comes from renewable sources, which sounds high compared to the 44% renewable share produced by NB Power. But Nova Scotia still uses fossil fuels to supply 40% of its supply, whereas in New Brunswick, fossil fuels account for only about 20% of supply, thanks to a hefty share coming from nuclear power. Sean Connell says the project is part of Nova Scotia Power's plan to increase their share of renewables.
I mean, it is a pilot project, so we are obviously learning, and part of that learning will be understanding customer feedback and what they're looking for. But it'll also be technical learnings as well, how the solar energy is produced, what type of the years versus other parts of the year produce more energy or not. And then we'll apply those learnings into hopefully future projects with other partners, communities across the province. We would love to do more of these.
That's Sean Connell, the Director of Customer Solutions at Nova Scotia Power.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
Each town or village contains its hidden treasures, and it's certainly the case in the village of Matsonville, Quebec, which is reconnecting with its history thanks to the initiative of Patricia Saint-Onge, who will be hosting private tours of the Pawden Springs site in Matsonville. Pawden Springs is a historical site dating back to the early 1800s, before the development of the area took off. The springs were discovered by Nathan Banfield while working afield for a local farmer. He was looking for water because he was thirsty, and Banfield stumbled upon a spring in the mountain that smelled like rotten eggs, marking the beginning of a unique period in the village's history. The spring, renowned for its medical benefits, became so popular that a railroad and a hotel were built near it to host international visitors. Many things have changed since. Our journalist Taylor McClure talks with Patricia Saint-Onge about her plans to host private tours of the Pottum Springs.
Before the area was really developed, it was basically discovered by Nathan Banfield in the early 1800s, who was working a field for a local farmer and was looking for water because he was thirsty. And he stumbled upon this spring in the mountain that smelled like rotten eggs and tasted funny. And it kind of took off from there because it's a natural mineral spring. And as it caught on, people would come from all over for the medicinal benefits, like it would cure all kinds of ailments. So that went on for years. And then in 1875, they actually built the Pottum Springs Hotel. So that kind of skyrocketed things. And the railroad was put through there, so there was a stop right at the hotel. And it was worldwide. People would come just to do the foot baths and there was apparently a pool under the hotel where they would heat the water that came straight down from the springs, and people would sit in there and they would drink it. They had all kinds of different treatments.
So it was almost like a retreat for people.
Almost like a spa was that kind of, yeah. And the property itself is beautiful. So even if it wasn't for that reason, it's a gorgeous area.
And who owned the hotel exactly, or who decided to build that hotel?
That's an excellent question. Mr. Green, I believe, was the one who actually built the hotel eventually, because it was on his land. But it went through a couple of owners, and then eventually it burned down in the 30s, unfortunately. But it's still got a lot of, all of the foundations are still there, and to go up to the springs, like the walk in the woods is beautiful. And up near the springs, there are all kinds of carvings in the rocks, like just names. And 1863, the Freemasons emblem, they had a big part of that property as well. And a lot of the stonework from the foundations you can still see was done very well and in different styles even. So the original hotel wasn't as big as the finished product because they added another wing farther on. Yeah, so they could accommodate like 75 people. Yeah, $2 a day. Seems crazy now.
And so how did you get these private tours set up? I know that it was on private property.
I learned to ask questions, I guess. I don't know. I feel so lucky that it turned out this way, because I've been itching to get up there because I went when I was a kid, and it's been years since I've seen any of it. And last summer, the Yoga Foundation, who owns the property now, was having they call it their annual picnic, so it's open to the public, and we all went, and Gérard Leduc was launching his book on Pottum Springs, so I got to meet him, and they did like a little tour, so it kind of ignited the spark, I guess you would say. So I've been walking around for almost a year going, oh, how do I get back there? There's so much stuff I want to see again, learn more about. So finally, I was just like, I'm just going to call. So I called the Yoga Foundation and spoke to Madame Dallaire, and she said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let me put you in touch with the caretaker. So I spoke with him, and everybody was on board, and they love their property. I mean, they've got some future plans for it, so they're very happy to have people be there, because it's a feeling. You have to actually be on the property to understand how amazing it just feels to be there.
And now that you're able to offer these tours, what can people kind of expect when you bring them through this site in terms of what they see or what they will hear? Can you give like a little sneak peek for people who are...
Absolutely. What we do is we're going to start like on the lawn, because there's a beautiful lawn where they used to do fencing and all kinds of neat things. So we'll start with a little bit of me talking about the history. And then I'm going to take them around the foundations and the old, like there are all kinds of foundations to check out. And my master plan is to actually blow up some of the old pictures so we can stand in the same spot and see, you know, the picture with what's left in the background. And that puts it into perspective a little better. And then we'll be going down to the river so they can check out some of the yoga retreats, buildings, and just the beauty of the river. It's so peaceful. It's such a beautiful spot with the birds and the trees. Some of the trees, I'm sure, could tell really great stories. And then when we come back up from the river, we'll finally head up to the springs. So we take the same path that they used to take the horse and buggies and put the people in the wagons or walk up, and the same stone steps that they built back in the 1800s are still there. All of the petroglyphs, it's just, you have to see it. You have to see it to understand it. There's so much history in this area. It blows my mind. The more you look, the more you learn, the more you learn, the more you want to learn. You just never know what you're going to find walking. I've literally stumbled in the woods on one of the places that I'd like to go to because I was just out for a walk. I just want to share it with people. It's such an amazing place. And like I said, you can't really put into words the feelings that you get when you're standing in some of these places. So it's really, I just want people to be hooked on history. It bothers me beyond words that history dies out so easily. And I'd like to eventually, through the tours, write a small series of books that are children's adventure stories, but that are all based on actual historical locations in the area. And eventually, because I always have a next, go into each of the homes, the elderly homes in Knowlton or around here, and just anybody who wants to tell me about their childhood memories, just take as many notes as I can so that someday I might be able to make them the little hero in a book that's actually about themselves. Oh. And then the kids learn through the elderly people sharing, and I love that.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So do you remember roller derby? Well, it seems to be alive and well in BC, more specifically where the Bulkley Valley Bruisers are on the prowl for fresh meat in the valley. This is the Bulkley Valley Roller Derby team with members from Smithers, Telqua, and Houston. They began competing in 2015 and were on a roll until 2020. Hellion Wheels, also known as Val Golder, is a team lead and remembers when they had to stop competing, practicing, and getting together to ride. She began in the BVRD Fresh Meat Program in 2020. I had just suffered an injury in the winter of 2020, so I was out of commission already, but I didn't expect that it would be 2 years before I'd be back on wheels, says Hellion, who wants to address some of the stigma that comes along with contact sport on wheels, so that anyone who is remotely interested in the valley feels comfortable enough to check it out. Smithers journalist Pamela Hassan spoke with Goder about the Bulkley Valley Roller Derby's comeback.
I definitely spent more time on the floor than on my feet.
Yeah, and so that's something that like you just get with practice, and that that's what these practices and scrimmages are for, is to kind of work on those skills.
Yeah. Then. Yeah, absolutely. No one's looking to like hit you on your first day or anything like that.
Right. Which is the next question, which is that you're going to get hurt immediately.
Definitely not. No, injuries are actually pretty rare. Most of the penalties that you can get during gameplay are in place specifically to avoid players getting hurt. And so it's really heavily, you know, watched and refereed. Yeah, the entire goal is to get stable and solid and confident enough that injuries are, you know, almost never happening.
Yeah, and that was the last one as well, was just that there's not really enough time to get comfortable that you're going to be thrown in. What is the culture of, you know, not just with the BV Roller Derby team, but also just kind of like the whole area here, or just the sport itself? What kind of culture does it mean to cultivate?
I think definitely the culture is meant to cultivate inclusivity and encouraging anyone to come out, because everyone belongs and there's no shape or size of derby player. Like, there's a place for everybody. There's a skill set for every position. Like, there's always some way that people can contribute if that's what they want to do, even just to, you know, be involved in the community.
How does the BV Roller Derby team prepare for fresh meat intake?
It's kind of ideally all hands on deck. So we have a lot of loaner gear. And so the idea for our first night is to have people come out, try on gear, try to skate for a little bit, take it off, let somebody else try, find what feels good, what feels bad, but also just to meet the team and try to get a feel for the fact that we are doing our best to be welcoming and encouraging, and just make sure that everybody knows that, you know, there's an opportunity to learn a new skill, make new friends, and challenge yourself in ways you probably haven't before.
Yeah, exactly. Like starting any new sport or whatever, it's like you're very nervous and you figure that everyone knows more than you do. But really, there's like going to be a pack of people that are all, it's their first time maybe even on skates. And I think that that's really exciting that, you know, that the culture, as you mentioned, is inclusive and to make everyone feel as comfortable as possible starting something new.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I would have to say my experience has definitely been something that's, encouraging, but allowing you to kind of build your own confidence too. So it's not coddling. No one's bruises definitely happen. And there is an art and a skill to learning how to fall safely and how to use your pads and use your gear to your advantage. And I think that that's something that for myself has been part of the overall challenge for me, in that I've never played a team sport before. I've never played a contact sport before. I'm the oldest person on the team with the least experience. I'm doing it because I love it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, at some point you have to let passion overrule your fear.
What's one thing about that you think people don't know about roller derby that they should know?
Well, there's no ball. That's a question that I get a lot. Like, what are you chasing? This beautiful combination of like skill and stability on skates, but being able to communicate with your team while you're, you know, demanding a lot of your own body and understand what's going on around you and the difference between, you know, should you be playing offense or defense? Like, there's a lot of tactical, and critical thinking on your toes involved. And that's not something I anticipated. Like, when you watch it, it just looks like, okay, these girls are just going to smash into each other until someone gets by. But there's actually a lot of strategy involved. And that's something that I'm still learning.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much.
A 70-year-old tractor is now being proudly displayed in the spot visible to the public on Cortes Island. Co-owners Joy Shipway and George Cirque say the utility vehicle has a rich history and has performed numerous and varying jobs for its many owners over the decades. Shipway recently moved the refurbished tractor to the end of her driveway. It's impossible to miss with its bright red color and large and slightly imposing figure amongst the rural forested landscape. And Shipway is, of course, very proud. She says it displays a legacy of the island's past, often forgotten, with few iconic symbols still visible from the 1950s and 1960s. In a world with so many disposable and limited life products, Shipway and Cirque say they're pleased to own an item contributing to Cortes Island's history. Greg Osoba met with the owners.
George Cirque says the tractor has a special place in Cortes Island's history.
Massey Harris Pony that you're looking at here, the tractor, is, I believe, the oldest running vehicle on Cortes Island, still operating unequivocally.
And Joy, you're the owner, but you co-own it with George?
We own it together, yes.
And is it still working? Yep. What do you do with it?
She runs just fine. She's a little rickety on the roads or on uneven ground, but we've used her in Cortes Island parades. And yeah, we just love vintage tractors and we wanted to keep her here on the island.
Do you use it at all for practical things like on your farm and homesteading?
No, okay. Not at this point. No.
So it's mostly for show these days.
Yeah.
How did it come into your hands?
came into my hands when she was dilapidated and retired and was over on George Cirque's property and he was leaving. And she ended up coming here because I really wanted her to come and be at the end of my driveway.
And yeah. There's a bit of a story, though, about how you managed to acquire...
I bid against Steve Ringwood in order to get this tractor. And I got her and put her at the end of the driveway and then heard some nasty rumors that Steve Ringwood was very upset with me for having won the tractor. And so I called him up and said, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to bid against you. I didn't realize that you restored tractors. And you know what? If that's what you're doing, you really deserve to have her. You can come and get her and we'll work out a trade later. And 45 minutes later, I heard sounds at the end of my driveway, machinery and cranes. And when I walked out, she was gone.
And the amazing story is that you did get it back refurbished.
Yes. George found that Stephen was selling the tractor and said, let's go in and buy this tractor back. And here she is. She's been reborn again like the phoenix.
And George, what do you know about the history and what it did and for the previous owners on Cortez and what kinds of jobs it functioned?
I think it came in the early 60s or maybe the late 50s. It's a 1953 tractor. And I believe the first place it actually worked was at the marina that used to be at the eastern end of the gorge. People don't associate a marina there, but there used to be one there as soon as you come down the hill. And it worked there launching boats. And from there was barged over to the Joan Goring property on the other side of the gorge. And then from there, when they sold their property, Jim Palmer, John Gregg, and myself bought the tractor from them. So it was three shares. And then Jim ended up taking it to Carrington on a barge. Tom Thompson took it there. And he had it there with Janet Gemmel for years and years and built a float system for a float house using the tractor to pull all these huge 40-foot long tanks around. And the tractor really suffered. The tractor went down there. I'm wrong. It went down the road. The Carrington Road. Jim had to make bridges for it. And as you can see, the tires are almost 4 feet high, right? So it can handle all kinds of terrain. And after that, it then was barged out and ended up at Redlands, which is the top end of Robertson Road. And it was there for years. And then I repossessed it finally. I bought Jim's share out. There's been more owners here than there are robins in the forest on this tractor. And then I took it to what I call the Outback next to Robbie, Graham, and Ann Dewar's place. And it sat there. And then from there, it hopscotched over here to Joy and David's place and sat out front till Steve Ringwood snatched it from here. And then he totally rebuilt it. Like you can see, beautiful bright red, new tires, new radiator, new batteries, worked on all the different systems of it. So he completely refurbished it.
Yeah. So Joy, just want getting back to you for a sec. So what inspired you to bring it out here and to be available to be viewed by anybody passing by?
She's such a beauty. Everybody should enjoy her. And I'm really proud of her. And she's just such a beautiful piece of machinery. And yeah, and then I'll be able to, like, it'll be a good sign to, when I'm apple pressing, I'll put a sign out in front of her and people will be able to find their way in. She just looks really beautiful at the end of the driveway. She even looked beautiful when she was rusty and worn out, but she looks more beautiful now.
It's traveled Cortez. Yeah. And we're going to give it a tune-up and sometime this spring, fire her up again.
Yep.
And this ends this edition of Viewpoints, produced by the Local Journalism Initiative and presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with campus and community radios across the country. Thanks to our journalists Pamela Hassan, Craig Osoba, Taylor McClure, Erica Butler and their guest, and to Maureen McEwen, our national coordinator, and to the artists who help us out with their music. You can listen to all our programs on canada-info.ca. Also tune in to all the stories produced by dozens of journalists working across the country on canada-info.ca. Their radio pieces are posted there on a daily basis. I'm Boris Chassaigne. Stay tuned to your local station. Thanks for being with us. Goodbye.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.